This is Jonathan Armstrong. I'm live from a rainy UK. I'm with Dwayne Morris. And Eric, why don't you introduce yourself?
And this is Eric Sinrod, also Dwayne Morris, but on the other side of the pond in San Francisco.
Where I guess it's sunnier than it is in the UK. And thanks very much for joining us for the next installment of Tech Law 10. For those of you who are tuning in for the first time, what Eric and I are doing is picking up a topic that's relevant to technology and the law, or ideally both, and we're trying to debate and talk through some of the issues as we see them on both sides of the Atlantic. I'm based in Europe, Eric's based in the US. We've looked at social networking already and the issues around cloud computing, and today I really wanted to look at discovery, because that's something, Eric, that we don't really understand in Europe. We don't have laws that are the same as yours. So why don't you give us a quick couple of minutes on why we should be bothered and why it's such a big issue?
Well, sure. In the United States, discovery now is all about e-discovery, and the E is not for Eric, my first name, but it's for electronic discovery. You know, frankly, these days, anything of any import is recorded electronically. And the name of the game in civil litigation, and sometimes even in criminal litigation, you know, has to do with how you can get your hands on, you know, the relevant data. And it's a big deal because there's so much out there, and it can be extremely onerous in any given case in terms of the exercise of, you know, harvesting and producing the relevant electronic data. Sometimes the cost of the discovery itself can outweigh the value of the dispute. So there are issues surrounding that. And then, of course, there's some major issues involving, you know, what happens if you don't get it right and you don't preserve and produce the correct information that's required.
Yeah, that's good. One of the issues that I see particularly is where a U.S. court or a U.S. Investigator orders documents to be moved out of Europe, and that obviously conflicts with data protection laws here, and it potentially conflicts with some countries, France being the noticeable example that has laws prohibiting data export that are going to be used in foreign proceedings unless you go through, you know, all of the proper convention routes. It seems to me that they're sort of pretty dramatic consequences in Europe. What are the consequences if I don't comply with an order in the U.S.? Can I go to jail?
You actually can potentially go to jail. There was a recent court decision where there was a party in a case that had repeated failures to cooperate and follow the judge's orders in terms of producing electronic discovery, and the judge just issued an order saying, okay, if you don't get it right next time, you're going to go to jail for 2 years. And by the way, you're paying a very stiff penalty as well. You can ensure yourself to be not in jail if you comply, but otherwise you can actually go to jail. We've also seen situations where sanctions for discovery abuse have been in the millions of dollars in an individual case. We've seen situations where default judgments have been entered because of the failure to cooperate in discovery. A judge has ruled your case is over. You lose. And, of course, if the case is a big one, that's a very large penalty.
And how big can this discovery process be? I mean, what's the in the UK we have something called disclosure, but that over time has been more and more limited. So theoretically, less and less documents have to be disclosed. How big are these exercises in the U.S.?
Well, it really depends on the case. I had one large antitrust case where 200 million separate electronic records were produced, but that was a very big case. And so what we're trying to do right now is, you know, trying to avoid mutual self-assured destruction in cases, and getting opposing counsel together right away to try to develop a joint plan that they can both live with for their respective parties. And you identify the relevant people, the custodians that might have information, then you agree upon some search terms, and then you run those search terms across those custodians and the data they have and try to come up with a finite set of information to produce. You know, it's not perfect. You're not getting every electronic grain of sand on the beach, but it's good enough. But there can be times when, you know, you have disputes between like an individual and a big company. So the individual wants everything from the company, and there just isn't that much to get from the company, by the company, from the individual. And sometimes you can go to court and basically say, look, you know, we believe that the information they're seeking is so burdensome and the burden so outweighs its probative value that if they want it, they have to pay for it. So there can be certain situations where judges will order cost shifting. And I believe there's situations where there are protective orders that go into place as well. And Jonathan, maybe you can speak to that.
Yeah, I've certainly been involved in protective orders where we've had that worry, as I've described, about getting information out of Europe and then it going into the wild. We've managed to get a protective order from the US courts and at the same time enter into a data transfer agreement which we could show to the European regulators if we had to. So the European bit, the data transfer agreement bit, I understand well. But talk me through this protective order process. How easy is it to obtain one of those?
Well, I mean, it's not that difficult to put together, you know, a motion and you go into court. And what you essentially have to do is you have to convince the judge or the discovery magistrate that, you know, the burden of the discovery is just far outweighs the value of the information being sought. And I think initially, you know, the judges and magistrates were a little bit reticent to that argument, thinking that, look, you know, you're in litigation, it's discovery, anything relevant must be produced. I think they're now starting to really, and it's not a situation where you just press a button and it all magically appears. I think they now understand that it's a humongous exercise to produce information. You're not just going, you know, to your network servers. You might have to harvest information from hard drives and you know, Blackberries and PDAs and going into backup tapes. And now there's even discovery of social networking sites. So it can be a phenomenal exercise, and I think judges are getting a little bit more understanding of the burdens associated with it.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about social networking particularly because you were telling me about this case that you've just had over there where the plaintiff was ordered to produce her, was it MySpace and Facebook records?
Yes, there was a plaintiff in a case that, you know, alleged that she was physically hurt and had loss of enjoyment of life because she fell off of a defective chair. So she sued the chair manufacturer. And the chair manufacturer noticed, their attorneys noticed that on her Facebook and MySpace pages, you know, her public viewing profile, she appeared smiling and happy and had done some travel. So they wanted court permission to get entire access to her entire Facebook and MySpace accounts to see whether the way she's living her life, as portrayed online, is inconsistent with her claims of physical injury and loss of enjoyment of life. And the judge agreed. You know, she tried to fight that, arguing that it was, you know, it was private and protected, and the judge disagreed, essentially saying that, you know, when you're on Facebook and MySpace, you're living your life out loud, and there's no guarantee of privacy, and the terms of use even say that. So, you know, be careful what you wish for.
Well, thanks ever so much for that. I was deeply skeptical that we could cover the topic of e-discovery in 10 minutes, but we seem to have almost done it. I guess people probably have questions. Eric, why don't you give your email address first?
Sure. Mine is ejsinrod, ejsinrod at duanemorris.com, duanemorris.com.
And I'm JP Armstrong at duanemorris.com. You can find us both on LinkedIn or on Twitter if you want any more information as well. And we're always keen to hear topics for future podcasts. What sort of things do you think we should cover? What makes your daily life a misery? Do let us know. And thank you very much for listening.
All right, we're signing off with our Tech Law 10. Until next time, thank you.